I have no disclosures to disclose. And I guess if I did, maybe I would disclose them. I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators on this project from the New England College of Optometry, Catherine Johnson, Stacy Lyons, Nicole Quinn, and Paulette Tattersall. And from Oxford University, Professor Josh Silver and David Crosby. The study was funded, as it says there, from Oxford University and from Imperial College in London through money forwarded from the World Bank. So first, I just wanted to touch a little bit on the scope of the problem of vision in the developing world. And quite obviously, there is a huge population of kids out there. Those children do not have the same access to eye care as children in the United States or other developed world countries, quite obviously. In addition, there is also the enormous problem of lack of manpower. There are places in Africa, countries in Africa, where there is one eye care provider for about 10 million people. In Boston, the numbers are a little bit better than that. Access to care for poor people in rural areas in terms of eye care in Africa is essentially non-existent. There is often some availability of eye care for people, call it in the ruling class in the capital city, but for poor people out in rural areas, it simply does not exist. And if there is a healthcare system available in some of these really poor countries, eye care is not one of the things that people pay very much attention to. Obviously, things like HIV or malaria, the stuff Bill Gates funds, World Health Organization funds, that's where the resources go. Resources simply don't go into eye care. So the bottom line, for children in poor areas in the developing world, there is no resource available. What are the prevalent ocular conditions affecting children in the developing world? Well, amazingly enough, they're just about the same as those affecting children in the developed world. The biggest problem by far is significant refractive error. In the developed world, refractive error in certain populations is much more common, myopia in particular. Myopia is probably less common by a lot in the developing world. Nonetheless, it's still the most prevalent problem. Amblyopia is the most important vision problem affecting children in the developed world. It affects about 3% of children in the U.S. and Europe. That number is probably not much different in Africa, although, to be honest, no one knows for sure because the epidemiologic studies are limited. There have been a large series of studies that are called the RESC studies, refractive error in school children, that were funded by the World Health Organization and also by the National Eye Institute in the United States. And those studies took place in about 15 countries. They looked at the epidemiology of vision problems in children from about 6 years of age up to 17 years of age, some variation depending on country. They looked mostly, however, at refractive error, although the data for amblyopia may or may not be quite as accurate. So 3% is probably a number that is true in the developing world as well. Strabismus in the developed world, somewhere, depending on whose numbers you believe and how you define it, maybe 3 to 6% of the population, and there's little reason to think that it's much different in the developing world. Eye disease is different. Prevalence of eye disease in young children in the United States is minimal. It's probably 1 in 1,000, maybe, depending on how you define it, 1 in 10,000. And at least in infants, most eye disease in the developed world is related to malformation of the eyes. Badly formed eyes, and we could argue about what you can do about it, but the fact is that if you're born with a bad eye, then you're probably going to still have a bad eye in this country. In Africa, it's the same thing. But there is an overlay of additional problems prevalent in those areas, specifically infectious disease. But infectious disease has also changed a lot. River blindness was rampant 20, 30 years ago. And then Merck, of all things, came out with a drug called ivermectin that has largely eliminated the problem in younger people, although if you go to remote villages in Africa, you still see large numbers of elderly people near the equator that are blind by river blindness. But in children, that's more a problem that's in the past than in the present. Vitamin A deficiency is one of the more amazing stories. 30 years ago, that was probably the most common cause of blindness in the developing world. And then somebody figured out that a little drop of vitamin A in a kid's mouth once or twice a year does the problem away for pennies. And in large part, that has been taken care of. So that's not a big problem anymore. Trachoma, formerly a big problem, much less so now, and probably will be even less so in the future. New therapies, new antibiotics become available, and treatment is now pretty universal. So again, the leading causes of infectious disease-related blindness in places like Africa are now, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, history, thankfully. So what we're left with, and certainly what we'll be left with 20 or 30 years from now, more so than today, is the same kinds of vision problems that affect children in the developed world. So I'm going to talk today about variable focus lenses. And this is sort of an interesting contraption. I'll show you a picture in a minute of one of the major types. But there are two types of variable focus lenses. One is a fluid filled, and I'll show you that in a second. The second is based on a technology called Alvarez lenses. Alvarez was a fellow who won a Nobel Prize, I think like 20 or 30 years ago, for his work. Remarkable stuff. If you haven't ever heard of it, it's kind of like a progressive edition lens. So in the middle, you've got Plano. You go up and to the right, you've got plus. Left and down, you've got minus. And if you take two of these and move them this way, you can come up with any kind of prescription you want. Very clever. And the interesting thing about Alvarez lenses, the first use of Alvarez optics was in, of all things, spy satellites. So the ability to take photos of license plates from 200 miles up is based on Alvarez optics. You can create exquisitely sensitive and accurate optical systems with Alvarez lenses that deal with aberrations to a degree that you can't do any other way. So at the highest level, Alvarez lenses provide just beautiful optics. The uses for variable focus lenses are a lot more basic than that. They work, but they're not quite as beautiful as the spy satellites, as you might guess. And those also cost a little bit more money. This is a variable focus lens. It's called the AdSpec. This was designed by a fellow, Josh Silver, who's one of the co-authors in this paper. Josh was the chairman of the physics department at Oxford University, and he was a self-described atomic physicist involved in things that we're not supposed to know about, and if anybody does, you could be killed for it. He was involved in weapons research, and for whatever reason, he needed variable-powered optical systems that could change very quickly. And he came up with those systems and then had one of these epiphanies, I guess is the right word. One night he woke up, probably in a sweat, and said, I don't want to kill people anymore. I want to, like, do good things. So he came up with the idea of a variable-focus lens that could be used for vision correction, particularly for poor people in places like Africa. There's sort of the current version, although not the future version. The black arrow points to a syringe, not unlike that used in a hospital, that is filled up with silicone fluid that fortuitously has an index of refraction of about 1.54, just about perfect. Now, you may remember a prior widespread use of silicone about 20 or 30 years ago. It got the company Dow Corning into some very serious trouble when their breast implants had problems. This is actually the same stuff, but I guess kind of like nuclear weapons, it's for good as opposed to evil. The white arrow is pointing to a dial, and you can rotate that dial and either inject or remove silicone fluid from a lens, which is the lens in front. And in doing so, you can change that power from roughly plus 6 to minus 6 diopters. So you can kind of sit there and you can just kind of dial it in and out, sort of like a pair of binoculars, not sort of conceptually very much different. And he designed this, and it works. This has been actually dispensed to 20 or 30 or 40,000 individuals around the world, mostly in Africa and Central America, and it provides correction. Now, you can take the apparatus off after you've arrived at the appropriate power and make it semi-permanent. Quite obviously, not many people, except for Josh, are going to wear these for very long. The style is a little bit Harry Potter-ish, if that good, probably worse. But for Josh, it actually works out pretty well. But for normal people, probably not so well. So there's a lot of effort going on now to improve the cosmetic design and to try to put the delivery system of the fluid inside the temple itself. But just think of this as sort of a prototype. This is really what it is. So, child self-refraction study. We carried out a study that was under the auspices of the Center for Vision in the Developing World, which is at Oxford University. The study was carried out simultaneously in Boston and in urban and rural China. Nathan Congdon, who some of you may know, formerly at Hopkins, was a fellow who carried it out in rural China, and another ophthalmologist who trained under Nathan at Hopkins, Mingguang He, did the study in Guangzhou in China. The goal of the study was to determine if self-refraction, which is the subject adjusting those crazy glasses themselves to arrive at a prescription, specifically self-refraction in myopic kids, let me underline that, can provide visual acuity comparable to that of a gold standard, and can provide refractive correction comparable to that of a gold standard. So the Boston study is all I'm going to talk about. I will mention that the Guangzhou study in urban China was published in the journal Ophthalmology in February. The Shantou China rural study was published in the British Medical Journal in April, and we're currently working on the paper for the Boston study. The subjects were recruited from 38 schools in the Boston area. There were a total of 350 subjects. We did the self-refraction process and the examination on our mobile van that was originally the Vision and Preschoolers study mobile van. It's got 10-foot exam rooms, two of them, fully equipped, etc. Self-refraction was mediated by an optometrist, and the exam was also carried out by an optometrist who was masked to the results of the self-refraction. Again, 350 subjects. The ages were 12 to 18 years of age. The median age is indicated as a little under 14 years of age. A few more females than males, and we attempted to have equal numbers, but it meant that the students had to actually exit the school building and go to the van. In many cases, the men disappeared. Why? We don't know. They had to have visual acuity of 20/40 or worse in both eyes, one or both eyes, corrected acuity of 20/32, myopia between 1 and 8 diopters, astigmatism under 250, no amblyopia strabismus. Results, of the 700 eyes, 98.72% got 20/32 or better visual acuity through their self-refraction. 92% of the 700 eyes got 20/25 or better acuity through their self-refraction. Only two subjects could not get 20/32 or better in their better eye. And only 9 eyes out of the 700 could not get 20/32 or better. Refraction results, the mean difference was less than a quarter diopter. Now, we anticipated there'd be a lot of over-minusing. For any of you who teach students how to refract, first or second year students, we are hopeful that they'll get somewhere within 12 diopters. Actually, diopter. Standard deviation was greater. And this was the sample of refractive errors, uncorrected. This chart shows the results. Now, this scatter, and the standard deviation is within the lines, but there was a fair amount of scatter. This is auto refraction under cycloplegia, obviously less scatter. And that's viewed in a different way, looking at the comparison between self-refraction and cycloplegic refraction. So pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good. From our perspective, the visual acuity was actually remarkably good. Very few eyes could not get at least decent vision through this self-refraction. Again, small number of eyes that couldn't get 20/32. The interesting thing is that there were 78 subjects that had astigmatism between a diopter and a quarter and 2 1/4 diopters. 78 eyes, I should say, not subjects. Not one of those eyes, in addition to their myopia, could not get 20/40 or better through their self-refraction. So people seem to worry a lot about, well, you're not correcting astigmatism, so, you know, it's not a good thing. But if your comparison is uncorrected myopia and astigmatism, or corrected myopia with residual astigmatism, getting 20/30 or better acuity, that's a pretty good trade-off. So the mean self-refraction was pretty close to that, and yet standard deviation was pretty large. Why the scatter? And what, if anything, can we do to reduce it? Well, we don't know. It may be that the 10-foot distance in Boston on the van might have caused some of it. The 20-foot distance in China actually had a little better result. So, you know, 20 feet is closer to infinity than 10 feet. Reduces accommodation a little bit. Maybe it's more accurate. We're not sure. The potential role of self-refraction, clearly from this study and the data from China, which was virtually identical to the Boston data. So in the three studies, there was really no significant difference. This was on over 1,000 individuals. It works as a refracting tool. Is it cheaper than an auto refractor? Yeah. Cost of these, by the way, are about $15 a piece at this point. Could it be a treatment tool? Well, if you take off the apparatus on the side and come up with a better cosmesis, it could be a treatment tool, but it's got a ways to go yet. Is a screening tool? Well, if you had a child and you did acuity testing on them and they got good acuity, do you need to do anything more if you're literally out in a rural area in Africa? Maybe not. If they don't get decent vision, you put these on, you have them do a self-refraction, and they end up getting good vision, you could presume they've got myopia and leave it at that, provide correction. But if they can't get decent vision, however you define that, then they probably could go on and get professional eye care with whatever resources might be available. So it might be useful as a screening tool. Conceptually, it also might be an early stage in the development of a systematic approach to eye care. So if you have people in a rural area who suddenly recognize that eye care is available, then they could start making demands on the system and ultimately sort of a push-pull economic effect. What's next? Well, clearly we need to design much better looking glasses. Nobody's going to really wear these in real life. So we need to do that. We need to figure out how this might be interjected into a healthcare system or an eye care system. And the idea that we've been working on is that ideally, this probably, at least in initial stages, should be placed in not a healthcare system or a vision care system, but in an educational system. Our idea is working within school-based settings. The World Bank has estimated that 10 years ago, only about 25 or 30% of children in sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, went to primary school, had any kind of primary school education. That number today is up to about two-thirds. They estimate that in 10 years, that number will be at 90%. Is there going to be a 90% penetration of a healthcare system, or more specifically an eye care system, in Africa in 10 years? Not likely. So it may be that within the educational system, this might be a place to go. And I thank you.